On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's ITRC online training, Characterization and Remediation of Fractured Rock. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I will serve as your moderator today. I will let you know how you can participate in today's training, and then I'll turn it over to our ITRC trainers. Today's training is an introduction to the ITRC guidance document, Characterization and Remediation of Fractured Rock. And although we are able to share a lot of information with you today, there's much more information available in that online guidance document. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to take a look at that, and we hope it will become a tool for you to use as you're looking and working on your fractured rock sites to help make that decision process a little bit easier for you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. We are scheduled for about 2.25 hours today. We are recording this event so we can provide it for archives for people that aren't able to attend our live sessions, or perhaps you would like to come back and listen to it again. The trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's presentation. If you would like to have your own copy of your slides to use today or to access at a later date for future reference, you're welcome to download a copy of those slides. You can access that from the related links section over on the right-hand side of your screen by clicking on CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse too. We want to hear your questions as well as your feedback during today's session. At any time, you are able to type in your questions in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen, and then that will come to us as the moderator and trainers. We will get to as many of those verbally as we can during today's Q&A breaks, one about midway through and the other at the end. If we're not able to get to all of those by answering those out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond back directly in writing to the person who asked the question. Also at our Q&A breaks, if you're just on the phone line today, we will give you an opportunity to ask your question out loud, and we'll remind you during those Q&A breaks that it is #6 to unmute. We do ask everybody complete our online feedback form. It will be accessible at the end of today's training on the last slide. It's also available in that related link section. Once you complete that online feedback form, you do also have the opportunity to receive a certificate of participation. Fill out that online feedback form and be sure to click that box at the end of the form to certify you participated. And once you do that, that certificate will be provided to you. Today's training is hosted by ITRC, along with our host organization, the Environmental Council of States, and we are a network of state regulators working alongside our federal partners, the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency, and our industry affiliates program members, academia, and community stakeholders. All of these members come together to develop tools and resources, such as the training you're participating on today, to help people make better decisions when they're working on environmental sites. ITRC does have a disclaimer available to you so you can learn more about how you can access and use ITRC materials. The full disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that ITRC usage policy and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty materials or endorse any specific products. Also, ITRC does have some ongoing teams renewing membership coming up here shortly, as well as some new teams kicking off. If you're interested in learning how you can be an active member of ITRC's teams or use any of our resources, please be sure to check out the ITRC website. It's now my pleasure to introduce our trainers for today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's Fractured Rock team over the year. And not only do we appreciate them volunteering to serve as trainers today and several past course offerings, we also very much appreciate all the work they put in over the years in developing the associated online guidance document. First, we will hear from Christopher McCandless. He's with the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. And then Jeff Hale with Parsons, Melissa Boysom with ERM, Ted Tyler with Kleinfelder. Also remember, you can access pictures and bios of all of our trainers on the link provided on this slide as well as the next slide. After the break, Q&A break, we will hear from Ryan Wymore with CDM Smith, Tamsin Macbeth from CDM Smith, and John Daugherty with CDM Smith as well. So thanks so much for our trainers for joining us today, And to all of you participants, we hope you will actively participate. And if you have questions, do be sure to enter those in the Q&A pod. At this point, we'll move on over to slide number 7, and I'll turn it over to Chris McCandless with the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. Chris?
Thank you very much, Mary. And I want to thank everybody on this webinar for attending, because I have I'm coming to you all having spent most of my career in the private sector, like you are, watching webinars and reading documents from that side of the fence, if you will, for most of my time. And now I've been fortunate to work with and now for a state that encourages and appreciates the understanding of bedrock hydrogeology and how to find and remediate hydrocarbons in this media. So we're dispelling the fractured rock site myth. Can these sites really be cleaned up? It's difficult, but not as impossible as you're going to find out. I strongly believe, I really do, having presented for this webinar several times now, I strongly believe this characterization or remediation of fractured bedrock document is a necessary tool for success in your field. So these next two pyramids, let me show you, these two guys, whoops, where is it? There we go, hold on a sec. There we go, these pyramids right here, the regular one and the one below it, the mirror image of it below, are pretty much the essence and purpose of this guidance document. Let me read you a little piece from the intro to the guidance document itself. Contaminated fractured rock sites have often been considered too complex to be remediated, so site managers often default to simply containing the contamination. This guidance provides a high-level introduction to the unique puzzle faced when investigating and remediating fractured rock sites. With the new strategies and technologies presented here, fractured bedrock challenges that may have prevented site remediation in the past are now surmountable. So let's talk briefly about the problems and challenges facing your company, the remediation company. Often the sites are considered too complex, or you might have difficulties in site characterization, leading to the uncertainty in the conceptual site model. We have an incomplete understanding of complex groundwater flow and contaminant transport in fractured rock. Where do I even hope to drill my first well when I can't see these other two sides? I can't see this side, or I can't see this side. Where do I even know where to drill? What tools do I use to understand fracture direction and ultimately flow? So perhaps we're trying to apply methods and formulas for unconsolidated porous media to the fractured media realm, and it's just not working. Perhaps with our limited or imprecise data, we choose to contain and monitor the contaminants instead of targeting them and cleaning them up. Or we spend too much time and money, but substantial risk remains. These mistakes can make our assumptions too broad and lead to setting unrealistic remedial action objectives, or RAOs. You see from that the authors have chosen to use red at the base of their pyramid to say a pyramid of expanding costs and uncertainty. So they say stop this wrong approach. Pick up this fractured rock document, read it on your laptop. It's web-based. Read it on your iPad while you're on site. Our objective today is to flip this pyramid on its top. Understand that there are resources available to manage the complexity of bedrock sites. We need to think of fractured rock hydrogeology as a different realm compared to the unconsolidated porous media. So I say, gather up your geologists and your earth scientists. Look at available geologic maps for rock type and structural symbols. If you're fortunate enough, measure strike and dip of fractures in the field. I had outcrops as part of an industrial laundry facility using chlorinated solvents and naphtha in, of all places, downtown Baltimore, Maryland. Just getting a few strike and dip measurements of the fractures, the foliation, measuring a few apertures, helped me understand the groundwater flow across the site and particularly to explain the subslab vapor hotspots. We will use that field data, the structural data, to understand our flow pathways of not only liquids, but vapors as well. The central point of this document and many other ITRC documents is the conceptual site model. It is truly the foundation upon which our understanding and remedial action objectives are based. And this document is going to help you develop a strong CSM, able to better target amendment delivery. If this is a different realm of the subsurface, what are the appropriate tools for measuring and assessing fractured bedrock hydrogeology? Well, later during this webinar, Ryan will introduce the tools matrix table. In it, you can see in the left column, in under hyperlinks, various surface and downhole geophysics to use as applicable to your site's specific geology. Since this document is web-based, this matrix is interactive, linking to fact sheets for the various methods. So, finding and using the right tools will get that data to bolster the existing CSM or create one that is specific to set remediation design parameters such as amendment, dose, and delivery. It will help the practitioner establish SMART remedial objectives. SMART meaning specific, measurable, applicable, relevant, and time-bound. Those remedial objectives will be SMART and cost-efficient, cost-effective, so your teams can make confident decisions and go beyond simple containment and monitoring. You see at the bottom here they have chosen to use green. Green says go. Go in the right direction. So, this guidance completes a succession of ITRC documents produced in the last 10 years that builds on ITRC's 2010 mass flux and mass discharge document, their 2011 integrated DNAPL site strategy document, and their 2015 integrated site characterization document. So it's the fulfillment of those three, and it's web-based. To lay out the process for properly establishing or augmenting your CSM, the authors have chosen to use puzzle pieces, as you can see here, geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry. Understanding contaminant fate and transport in fractured rock allows site managers to develop a robust CSM that can guide remediation. Specific geology and lithology and structural control, the unique mechanics of fluid flow in fractured rock. In addition to these physical properties, chemical properties affect fate and transport and are equally important in developing the CSM. So, what we're talking about geology here is physical characteristics, type of bedrock, physiographic province of the site. Under hydrology, not hydrogeology, but hydrology, because what we want to emphasize here is the flow characteristics through the fractures and the matrix. And then the chemistry is the chemical characteristics of the contaminant. The keys to your success lies in the skill sets of all these experts in your organization. This guidance further introduces the parameters necessary for developing a fractured rock CSM and stresses the need for an experienced multidisciplinary team. Okay, what do you need to know about fractured rock? Well, they've taken these three puzzle pieces and they have broken it out into basically a tree. So let's look at this. Let's look at the geology particularly. Similarities and differences. So bedrock versus unconsolidated porous media. This is your translation tree. Get it right here. And where is that arrow? No arrow. Anyway, it's look on the left side here. This translation is tree is telling you how to translate the familiar terms of geology or hydro into the bedrock terms. The rounded rectangular branches on the left represent fractured bedrock properties, and the oval branches on the right represent the corresponding concepts in unconsolidated or porous media. To give you a little closer view, for instance, let's look at lithology and say, okay, on the bedrock side, we have competent weathered bedrock types, and on the unconsolidated, and then on the unconsolidated porous media side, the term lithology is looked at as unconsolidated sediment types, and so forth, microtextures, grain sorting, et cetera. So here's how today's webinar is mapped out, which follows the same order of the chapters in the document. Jeff Hale will discuss geology and physiographic provinces, which is Chapter 2. Melissa Boyson will discuss hydrology and chemistry, Chapters 3 and 4. Ted Tyler will discuss fate and transport. And then we'll have our first Q&A session with Mary and the trainers. Ryan Wymore will pick up and discuss tools to develop the CSM. Tamsin will discuss remedy selections in Chapter 6. And John Doherty will finish up by discussing developing a monitoring strategy from Chapter 7. And then we'll have a final Q&A session. Our next speaker is Jeff Hale, and he's a professional geologist at Parsons in Pittsburgh. Jeff?
Thanks, Chris. So I'll pick it up from here and really get us kicked off on the technical discussion, focusing on terrain analysis, or really looking at the landscape, maybe at area, regional scale, to get a sense of the characteristics of the underlying bedrock. So the underlying bedrock, the type of rock, its structural characteristics can substantially influence the landscape, the terrain, the topography, whatever you want to call it. So by looking at the landscape, it gives us some insight into what we might be dealing with the fractured rock underneath. And those same characteristics or features of the fractured rock also can impart influence to groundwater flow and contaminant transport. So this is a really important first step that you can do right at your desktop before you initiate your investigation or begin to construct your conceptual site model. So I have an example here. On the right-hand side, we've got a map of the eastern United States. This is a physiographic province map. We're looking at the Piedmont physiographic province, which is number 19 in pink. And just looking at this map, at this subcontinental scale, if you will, you can see there's a definite orientation to the fabric of the physiography in this part of the country. It's oriented northeast, southwest. And when we look at an image of that area on the left-hand side, this black and white image, it's a light detection and ranging or LIDAR image of a portion of the Piedmont province, you can see that same sort of pattern, east, northeast, southwest, fabric to the landscape, bridges and valleys, et cetera, oriented in that direction. So that, as we'll show, is really a function of the bedrock geologic characteristics underneath, which also impart influence to groundwater flow and contaminant transport. So again, this is a very important first step that's going to guide your investigation and help you start to construct your conceptual site model. It's usually inexpensive and can be done right at your desktop or through site reconnaissance. So speaking of site reconnaissance, we're zooming in a bit here. This is a different location but similar setting. We're at the outcrop scale, actually standing on the outcrop itself. This is a metamorphic bedrock. The layers in this rock are called foliation. As you can see in the photo in the bottom right-hand corner, that foliation projects into and out of the photograph. And that linear orientation is where the stream valley on the left-hand side formed. So the stream follows that layering, the valley follows that layering, and this starts to give us some insight into how it might influence groundwater flow. So groundwater is going to tend to flow towards the stream due to the hydraulic gradient, but it's also going to want to follow the path of least resistance, which is along those foliation planes or layers. So in a bedrock situation like this, you may get a very predictable situation where you could expect groundwater flow to be flowing along those plains, but it might not be what you would typically expect because it's not flowing directly towards the stream. But just by walking around and inspecting your outcrops, as Chris had mentioned, can give you a lot more insight into your conceptual site model. And that's what this slide is intended to indicate. You basically, again, starting that high level or initial conceptual site model, what we have here, you see two columns. We have the typical elements of any conceptual site model, you know, a source, hydraulic boundary conditions, potential, you know, such as rivers and streams, potential receptors such as supply wells, a hydraulic gradient that will influence your groundwater flow direction. So you can start arranging these things geometrically as they occur in real life and see if you have any receptors that might be in the line of fire or not. But an important distinction here is the difference between the left-hand column of graphics and the right-hand column of graphics, which illustrate the differences in what's called isotropic conditions or anisotropic conditions. So in the isotropic case, you could consider this like a sandbox or horizontally bedded sedimentary rock, where groundwater could flow horizontally with equal ease in any direction, and its groundwater flow direction is really going to be dictated by the hydraulic gradient. So nothing impeding groundwater flow in any particular direction, and it's just going to follow the hydraulic gradient. On the right-hand column, it illustrates a bit of what we had just talked about in the previous few slides, where you may have tilted, layered rock, metamorphic rock, bedded sedimentary rock, for instance, where fluid flow is going to want to follow the path of least resistance or along the bedding or foliation planes, the partings in the rock, and whatever the orientation is, that's going to influence the groundwater flow direction. So on the right-hand side, you get the hydraulic influence that's the driving force for fluid flow, but you have this directional component where the direction of the bedding planes, foliation, fractures, et cetera, influence the direction of your bedrock. And with desktop materials, geologic maps, et cetera, you can start to create your conceptual site model like this just at your desktop. Again, it's simplified, but it's a good start. It will help you point you in the right direction. So with all that said, I want to present a real-life example that starts to pull all of this together. So I've been emphasizing these metamorphic foliated rocks and, you know, sedimentary rocks that have bedding. There's a variety of influences that different bedrock types can have, but in this instance, we're still looking at a foliated or layered metamorphic rock in the Piedmont Physiographic Province of the eastern United States. So you're probably familiar with the fabric of this terrain by now because we've looked at it a bit. But as we talked about, you know, we see these valleys and ridges, and the topography and the drainage really follows a prominent northeast-southwest direction. This figure also puts on the bedrock geology, so the different colors of the different rock types underneath the landscape. And you can see the geology itself, the rock types themselves, follow this northeast-southwest orientation. Direct your attention to the photograph on the bottom right. This is an outcrop view of in this case, a metamorphic rock schist and its foliation or layering. As you can see, it's layered and tilted. And this is ground zero. This is where the release actually occurred at this site. It was a gasoline release, or an El Napel, that would have migrated diagonally down these partings or foliation planes until it hit the water table. And once it hit the water table, it was going to, again, follow the path of least resistance, which would be along these partings or planes or foliation, in this case, into or out of that photograph. So I'll direct your attention back to the map itself. You see there are a number of light blue dots. Those light blue dots are supply wells in the area. So several potential critical receptors in this area. So this is important. The dark blue dots are monitoring wells that were installed to investigate this issue. And the yellow dots are monitoring wells that had measurable LNAPL liquid gasoline product, whatever you want to call it, measurable in those wells. And it's evident that that LNAPL, once it hit the water table, flowed on nearly a perfect straight line to the northeast and southwest, strictly dictated by the orientation of that bedrock foliation. And in this case, relatively few supply wells were impacted. And it goes to show that in a critical situation like this with so many receptors, bedrock is not necessarily too complicated to figure out. So basically, with some desktop analysis, you can really get an idea of what to expect in this setting. And the monitoring well network almost becomes confirmatory as opposed to leading the investigation. So we've talked about a number of aspects of terrain analysis and conceptual site models. This is a tool called the Terrain Analysis Matrix. You'll find it in the tech reg document. It's really just intended to help you organize your approach to conducting terrain analysis and to begin that high-level construction of your conceptual site model. Again, it really just organizes and lists out the things we talked about. So across the top from 1 to 6, we have, be cognizant of what your receptors are. Take stock of your regional setting like we've done in the prior examples, looking at the physiographic provinces, for instance. Knowing the rock type is very important. A granitic pluton and a layered sedimentary rock are going to give you two different scenarios. Understanding the structure. So here we're just looking at, in column 4, we're just looking at sedimentary rocks, but those rocks could be horizontally bedded, inclined, vertical, or folded and faulted. And each one of those circumstances can influence your fluid flow in different ways, and tips for interpreting that are provided under column 5, anisotropy and heterogeneity. And lastly, column 6 talks about the hydrology. So you can see regional drainage patterns, which might be an indication of the orientation of the underlying rock type, but also give you a sense of the hydraulics that would be influencing your groundwater flow direction. So this is really just to help organize your approach and help you take stock of these critical terrain analysis considerations when you're starting out your investigation and building your conceptual site model. So lastly, in my section, we want to touch on karst. So as you may know, karst forms in chemical sedimentary rocks by dissolution. So things like solution cavities, voids, conduits, sinkholes, caves. Obviously, these features can have significant influence on fluid transport. But they're, again, it's formed by dissolution of these rock types more than mechanical breaks and fractures. It's really a field in itself, so we won't get too deep into it here. But Appendix A of the Tech Reg document does get into karst in more detail. So that is the section on terrain analysis, really looking at your landscape, that first step in guiding your investigation or your conceptual site model. There's a lot more to fractured bedrock than that high-level view, and the subsequent authors will get into that. But next, Melissa Boyson with ERM will talk about the hydrology, and we're really pouring the water into the conceptual site model in that framework now. So over to you, Melissa.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. This section, I'm going to start us off with a poll question. So if you would bring that up, please, Mary. And the question is, which of these is the most important question for determining flow in fractured rock? So while you are thinking about your answer to that, I'm going to go ahead and continue. And I will return us to the figure 1-1 that Chris introduced earlier. So we'll take a closer look at the middle portion that compares the hydrology of fractured rock to unconsolidated deposits. In fractured rock, you're looking at consolidated layers or continuous crystalline rock versus unconsolidated material. For permeability, we consider fracture apertures and fracture connectivity rather than grain size and sorting. Porosity is in both fractures and matrix to varying degrees, and rather than the single porosity that we would expect in most unconsolidated matrix. Flow direction is anisotropic and influenced by fracture orientations or bedding planes. And depending on fracture aperture, you can have laminar or turbulent flow. And this is most evident in karst, as Jeff mentioned, that is a whole other appendix for you guys to look at. Hydraulic advection is controlled by structure and fracture connectivity rather than the hydrostratigraphic unit. So returning to the poll question, I see that the consensus is, how does it move? And I will admit that this is a trick question. And really, there's not a right or wrong answer here, because the answer is specific to a site, project goals, or the project stage. If you can close the poll now, Mary, please. All right, so moving on, and just to help us answer these questions, I'd like to review some of the terminology presented in this figure. And this is figure 3-2 from the guidance. You've already heard some of the terms already, and we will continue to use them throughout the training. So first of all, where is the fluid? Is it, do we find it in the matrix here? Or is it also in the fractures? And the matrix here is the unfractured portion of the rock. Some of the characteristics of the fractures include orientation. So that would be the geometry of the fracture with respect to the land surface, but sometimes with respect to bedding or layering or other fractures. The aperture would be the thickness or the opening of that fracture. And terms such as infilling or dissolution refer to how that fracture aperture can change. The length is just how long or extensive that fracture is, and that relates to the density and connectivity of the fracture. So how many fractures are there, and do they form a connected network? Looking more closely at the fracture surface, we have features such as planarity and waviness, and this just refers to whether or not that fracture is undulating across its length, or does it have a more linear pattern. And then roughness, zooming in even more closely, would refer to the actual individual fracture surfaces. So thinking about the other questions, the way the fluid moves through the fracture or the fluid properties, we want to start thinking more about these characteristics. So for example, things like roughness or aperture would affect how our fluid moves, where if we had a very rough surface or a very thin aperture, it would impede groundwater flow. So it is important to think about things like this when you're really looking close at fracture flow. So fractured rock is just the general term that we use. But when we're characterizing the rock, we're really looking at the rock type, whether it's sedimentary, igneous, or metamorphic. And this photo that I've got up here is just of the Grand Canyon, and the purpose is to show you a side-by-side comparison of the differences in sedimentary and crystalline rock. So sedimentary rock is at the top here, and you can see that it's very layered and orderly, dominated by that layering that was formed by the deposition of each layer. The crystalline rock, shown below here, shows that it's more massive, the layering isn't visible or prominent, and the dominant structures you see are related to some fracturing, but not an overall layering of the rock. Now, this is an oversimplification, so I'll break it down for you now. So this is a cross-sectional view of sedimentary layers with the land surface at the top. When characterizing sedimentary rocks at your site, you're looking at both fracture porosity and matrix diffusion and their relative importance. Depending on sedimentary rock type, the fractures can represent the dominant flow path. But where the rock has a more porous and open matrix, some of the overall flow may be within the matrix. Bedding planes can create preferential flow pathways, and they can also isolate different hydrogeologic domains, such as shown here with the plume A and plume B here. The fracture systems within sedimentary rocks can be more orderly or predictable within the layers, and they can often change across lithologic layers depending on how strong or weak the rock is. In addition to rock strength, the composition can also control the extent to which mechanical and chemical weathering affect fluid migration in the fractures. For example, increasing the aperture size or infilling. So here is another cross-sectional view, this time of a crystalline rock site with the land surface at the top here. And in this case, the fractures may be the only significant porosity in the system. Depending on fracture distribution and density, the fracture sets can also represent relatively isolated hydraulic systems, similar to the behavior as shown in the previous sedimentary example. So on this figure here, we'll focus on these two layers here, this weathered portion and this unweathered portion. And you can see in the weathered bedrock that the fractures are more connected here. The shading on this figure implies that we've got more porosity in the matrix, and so that it can store fluid. In contrast, the unweathered bedrock here contains fewer fractures, and the matrix diffusion, if any is present, is limited to the area immediately adjacent to these fractures. In the case of metamorphic rocks, you may observe more layering, and some of those layers may have primary porosity. And depending on the composition and how metamorphosed or changed the rock is, fracture systems in crystalline rocks are caused by local or regional forces, and they can be more orderly or predictable in layered metamorphic rocks, as we saw with Jeff's example, or more chaotic in an igneous rock. The notable exception is where you have columnar jointed basalt, where the vertical joints are formed during cooling and are very regular. And as with sedimentary rocks, composition can also dictate the extent of mechanical and chemical weathering and its effects on fluid migration. For example, chemical weathering of rocks with high feldspar content can leave behind clay minerals that would actually fill in fractures. So when we discuss fluid flow in fractured rock and how we drive our investigation approach, we look at rock matrix porosity, which is represented by this figure here, discrete fractures, or these individual fractures here, interconnected networks, so looking at this circle here where the fractures intersect one another, or we look at the interaction of all three of these aspects. The matrix porosity is where the water and dissolved constituents can reside in the unfractured rock, though it may not contribute much to overall flow in the system. You may, however, need to direct your investigation to the matrix when your primary concern is storage or release of constituents from the matrix. Discrete fractures can be large, and if they're long, they can transport constituents long distances from the source. But if they're not well connected, they may have limited importance in your investigation except for the storage that they represent. And when you have an interconnected network, it's usually the primary focus early on in the investigation because this is where most of the flow is occurring and probably where your wells are screened and sampled. As with the poll question at the beginning of this section, there isn't a right or wrong answer for which of these flow features is most important to focus on because it depends on what project stage you're at and the overall goals for the site. So I'll briefly touch on some fluid-specific factors just to get you thinking about how flow may change through your fractured rock system. Flow is driven by pressure gradients and density gradients. So in this figure, for example, the red lines represent potential flow pathways. And starting at the land surface, you may have potential flow paths through the overburden or the unconsolidated soil, going into the saprolite or the weathered bedrock, and then you have fewer flow pathways than you did in the overburden. And then going into the unfractured or unweathered portion of the bedrock, you have even fewer flow pathways. So these flow pathways, as we get deeper, require higher pressure and density gradients for the fluid to migrate as the fracture aperture and pore size decreases. So when you have multiple phases involved, When such as an apple encounters the water table, you need to understand the pressure required for each phase to migrate, which phase is the wetting phase, which is the phase that coats the surface of the fractures or pores, and which is the non-wetting phase, which is what would fill in the remaining pore space. I'd also like to direct you to the fractured rock appendix of the LNAPL update, and that contains additional information on this particular topic. So other considerations include whether your fluid is moving slow or fast. There may be a scale dependence on this, to where turbulent flow may dominate at the scale of an individual fracture, but across an interconnected network, it may more resemble laminar flow. So for the rest of the fracture flow discussion, we're going to focus on the scale of an investigation and when certain attributes are most important. This graphic, which is figure 3-1 in the guidance, is a qualitative summary of the scale at which you would focus on a certain attribute of fracture characteristics, hydraulic properties, flow mechanisms, and transport mechanisms. In the following slides, we'll focus on these three scales, macroscopic, mesoscopic, and microscopic. We'll look at how they're defined and how each of these scales is typically investigated, and the information you get from this scale that helps you shape your conceptual site model. It's also important to note that these scales should only be investigated to the extent that's practical for your site and for the particular project stage in your or the project lifecycle. So macroscopic flow occurs at the site-wide or regional scale, where the remote sensing tools that Jeff Hale described earlier in this training are more applicable. And this is where we look at how features such as faults, rivers, tides, and major changes in lithology could influence flow. Fracture attributes such as orientation, length, and connectivity are important, and overall the flow behaves like a laminar flow system. Investigations often begin with a regional overview, and from this point you can better define the direction that the investigation needs to take at smaller scales. Mesoscopic flow, and this is really where we learn the most about our site. The mesoscopic scale focuses more on plume delineation and flow between boreholes and wells. Attributes such as orientation, aperture, density, length, and connectivity are the focus of an investigation. At this scale, matrix interactions start to become more evident. Because this is the primary scale at which we investigate a site, there's no shortage of tools for hydraulic testing or fracture analysis, and we'll go into that more in detail later in this training. And before we move on to the next scale, Mary, could you please bring up the next poll question? So if you would please take a moment to answer which of these is the general representative range of in-situ fracture aperture in millimeters in the upper few hundred feet of rock. So while you're answering this, I'll move on to the microscopic scale. I'll just give you a few more moments. See, we're getting very close to the correct answer. The correct answer is actually 0.5 to 0.5. So 0.5 millimeters is the approximate width of five standard sheets of standard paper, and that is the approximate thickness, just to give you an idea. And the New England case study that will be presented later in this training shows a good example of how this fracture aperture changes with depth. You can go ahead and close the poll question, Mary. So microscopic scale, this is where the primary focus is on the morphology of individual fractures and the interaction between fracture and matrix. This is typically done through direct measurements on core samples. At this scale, you may focus on the morphology of a fracture and how the aperture changes across its length or with depth. You may also investigate diffusion and capillary flow at this scale. And while this scale is not typically used to delineate plumes, it may become an important scale when it's time to start thinking about a remedy for a site and answering the questions, where is the bulk contamination located and how can a remedial technology reach all of that contamination? So we started out with this section thinking about those three main questions. Where is the fluid? Are there multiple phases and how does it move? These questions are all important depending on your site needs. You should now be able to take this information and add it to your conceptual site model. If there are multiple phases at the site, you've started to look at how those phases interact, and you've also considered these data across multiple scales. The next step will be to consider how this information helps you understand the migration of chemicals. And with that, I'll introduce Ted Tyler with Kleinfelder, who will talk about fate and transport. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. So we've talked about the geology of fractured rock, and we've talked about the hydrology of fractured rock, and now we talk about the fate and transport of contaminants in fractured rock settings. And beginning with a few high-level contaminant fate and transport mechanisms, density-driven vertical migration, dissolution into the fractures, and subsequent advection down gradient, matrix diffusion and back diffusion having to do with the partitioning from the fractures into the rock matrix, sorption and retardation of the contaminants, depending on the extent of organic matter along the fracture walls or within the rock matrix, and degradation, whether it's abiotic or biotic, depending on the particular contaminants you're dealing with. To focus on a few of these in particular, looking at the graphics on the right, starting with the top graphic, this is a crystalline rock, so there's no appreciable rock porosity. So the dissolved phase moves through the fracture relatively unimpeded. As compared to the next graphic in the middle, this is a sedimentary rock with some level of matrix porosity, so the dissolved phase does partition to some extent from the fracture into the rock matrix, which has the overall effect of slowing down the advance of the plume. In the third graphic on the bottom right, here we have a sedimentary rock with both rock porosity as well as organic matter present, and the net result is a even further retardation and slowing of the advance of the plume or of the dissolved phase. Looking now at the fate and transport of individual contaminants in fractured rock settings, this is a tool to examine a particular contaminant. It can also be used for multiple contaminants to compare between them. Ultimately, to look at the particular properties of that contaminant and what the implications are for the fate and transport. Some of the properties we consider, for example, for TCE here, are liquid density, its tendency to sink in groundwater, vapor pressure, the likelihood of a vapor phase contaminant in the source area, solubility, representing its tendency to partition into the fracture dissolved phase, Henry's constant, its tendency to off-gas from fractures into unsaturated fractures or the overburden, and KOC, representing its tendency to sorb to organic matter, whether along the fracture walls or in the rock matrix. And then finally, reactivity for some contaminants, representing its tendency to, or amenability to, abiotic degradation through interaction with the particular mineralogy of the fractured rock. Now, if you add a color scheme to this, the colors can be used to highlight ultimately the fate and transport mechanisms that are implied from the particular properties of a contaminant. And again, this can be used for multiple contaminants, but here we look at just one TCE. So liquid density is highlighted in blue, implying that this is a chemical that will sink in groundwater. The vapor pressure and Henry's constant are highlighted in green, indicating that this is a chemical that will both potentially have soil gas presence in the release area as well as potential soil gas off-gassing from the dissolved phase down gradient. And the solubility in purple indicating this is a chemical that will likely dissolve and is a potential candidate for both matrix diffusion and long-term back diffusion. KOC is highlighted in kind of a khaki brown here indicating this is a chemical that will strongly sorb to organic matter. And lastly, the reactivity in this case is highlighted in kind of a pink, indicating this is a chemical that is amenable to abiotic degradation through interaction with the fractured rock mineralogy. So moving now to contaminant mixtures, this is an example of a feed and transport of a contaminant mixture, in this case a dean apple and a sedimentary rock. As discussed on the bullets on the left and illustrated in the graphics on the right, and beginning with the top graphic, we have a dean apple released in what's now called the early time, migrates downward under the force of gravity through the fractures, some degree of horizontal movement, but ultimately encounters groundwater and moves through groundwater, continuing downward through the fractures. But in the early time, the only phase represented is the dean apple phase. Over time, as represented by the second graphic, that dean apple partitions into the dissolve phase as well as into the rock matrix, as represented by the orange shading. And over the long term, the dean apple is now gone. This is the lowest graphic on the far right. The dean apple is now gone. The high level or high concentration dissolve phase is no longer present. However, the reservoir of mass that has found its way into the rock matrix now acts as a long-term source, back diffusing into those fractures, potentially at concentrations in excess of your cleanup levels. Continuing with the theme of contaminant mixtures and the fade and transport in fractured rock, looking initially here at an elm apple, and beginning with the concept of strike and dip, the strike is the orientation of a fracture relative to the horizontal plane. The dip represents the angle of that fracture relative to the horizontal plane. Looking at the first bullet and the graphic at the lower right, as an elm apple is released, it follows the dip on the unsaturated zone until encountering groundwater, at which point it moves along the strike, being less dense than water, it doesn't sink. So it moves along that strike. If the in the case of a vertical fracture, it is it can be difficult to find the fracture and ultimately to triangulate and find where this elm apple is present. However, as the angle of that dip increases, the fracture is more likely to be encountered with a with an investigation, and through triangulation, you're more likely to be able to locate the elm apple considering the depth of water. Lastly, if you have horizontal fractures, then an additional consideration for the directionality in fade and transport of the elm apple is the hydraulic gradient, which comes into play. For a dean apple, same concept of dip, strike and dip, and again, looking at the first bullet and the graphic on the lower right, is that dean apple enters the fractures in the unsaturated zone, it migrates downward, encounters groundwater, is more dense than groundwater, so sinks until it either runs out of mass or encounters the bottom of the fracture, at which point it then moves along the strike of the fracture. Now, a shallow well, as you can see from the graphic at the lower right, is very likely to miss the dean apple. And as the angle of the dip moves towards horizontal, the location of the dean apple could be even more problematic to find. However, the footprint of the dissolve phase, as you can see in that graphic, would begin to express itself over a greater area, making it increasingly likely to find that, which can be used as a line of evidence to ultimately find the dean apple. And as with elm apple in the last bullet point, with a horizontal fracture, hydraulic gradient again becomes an important factor in the directionality and fade and transport of a dean apple in that instance. Moving now to the 21-compartment model, this is an adaptation from the 14-compartment model originally presented by or developed by Tom Sale and Chuck Newell and documented in ITRC's Integrated Dean Apple Site Strategy document, or the IDSS document, a few years back. And this effectively is a tool to represent the CSM, and Ryan Wymore will discuss the CSM a little bit later. But this is a tool to represent the CSM at a level of resolution for making high-level decisions with regard to characterization objectives or screening technologies or the like, and there's more information in the document. The way this 21-compartment model is organized, beginning with the top two rows on top, it's divided into source zone as well as downgrading extent. Each of these are further subdivided according to the various transmissivities, matrix storage representing the rock matrix, matrix flow representing that potential flow through the rock itself, which sometimes happens, fracture flow obviously representing the flow through the fractures within the fractured rock, And then those subdivisions are repeated in the downgradient extent. The model further subdivides the compartments according to the phase of contaminant on the first column on the far left, including vapor phase, NAPL, dissolved, and sorb phase. So as an example of that, here we have a DNAPL release into what's called here an uncemented sandstone. I'll point out uncemented is probably an older term, perhaps better identified as poorly cemented or friable sandstone. However, the colors here represent the relative degree of mass, orange being a high mass or high concentration, yellow being moderate, and green being a low amount of mass or low concentration. And what this particular graphic shows is that the highest concentrations are present, or the highest mass, in the source zone within the fractures in the NAPL phase. Now that NAPL phase, is evident from the graphic, has subsequently partitioned within the fractures of the source zone in the vapor, dissolved, and sorb phase, and additionally partitioned into the rock matrix, being a sandstone. And there's an appreciable matrix flow in this instance. In addition, the dissolved phase within the fractures, as shown in the yellow, has migrated down gradient, also shown in yellow in the down gradient portions, and subsequently partitioned at that location into the rock matrix as well. Now, as you look at a different type of sedimentary rock, in this case a shale bedrock, so this is similarly a DNAPL release into a shale bedrock, the model simplifies a little bit because in this case we do not have the matrix flow. However, we still have matrix storage potential as well as fracture flow. And at a glance, what the colors again show is the highest mass in the DNAPL and the fractures in the source area, the partitioning into those fractures as vapor dissolved in sorb phase, somewhat partitioning in the rock matrix, and then an eventual advection down gradient of the dissolved phase in the fractures is represented by the yellow, and then subsequent, ultimately, partitioning into the rock matrix is shown by the green. On the last example here, the model further simplifies. Now, this is a granite, so there's no matrix flow, there's no appreciable matrix storage. We're dealing primarily, although the angles of the fractures can be chaotic as compared to sedimentary rock, the model itself simplifies here, and we're looking predominantly at fracture flow. So the story is much simpler here. You have a DNAPL release where the highest mass is in the fractures in the source area, partitioned into the vapor dissolved and sorb phase, and then moved down gradient through the fractures, and similarly partitioned into the vapor dissolved and sorb phase. Now, again, the next speaker will talk about CSMs in more detail. This graphic here presents a graphic illustration of a CSM. The main point I have of it is that it's complicated, and there's a lot of essential detail there, very important, but for the purposes of making some of the higher level decisions, if you overlay this 21 compartment model, you are able to, first of all, produce the 21 compartment model in just a few minutes. It doesn't take very long at all. But you're able to see this CSM at a level of resolution for making some high level decisions with regard to your characterization, screening technologies, and the like. And there's a lot more information on that in the document itself. With that, I think we have a question and answer period.
Thanks, Ted. Yes, we do have our first question answer break. If you do have a question, please be sure to type it in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. For those of you on the phone line, in just a moment, I'll give you an opportunity to ask your question out loud if you would like to do so. And remember, that is #6 to unmute. But before we get to questions, I do want to do a sound check with one of our trainers. John, can you speak up on the phone to make sure we can hear you?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much, John.
Let's go on. Great. How do I mute myself again? I'm sorry.
Hit *6.
Thank you.
*6 mute, #6 to unmute. So for those of you on the phone line, if you'd like to ask your question out loud, I'll give you a moment to go ahead and do that now. Any questions from our phone line audience? Well, we're waiting for some questions to come in. I'll go ahead and let you know about some upcoming online ITRC training classes. This Thursday on November 21st, we have long-term contaminant management using institutional controls. On December 3rd, TPH risk evaluation at petroleum contaminated sites. And we wrap up our 2019 online live training schedule with stormwater best management practices. Registration is open for those events. We'd encourage you to register and participate if that's a topic of interest. And be sure to let others know about the availability of these online training events. Also, for those of you who are interested in getting continuing education documentation, we do offer certificates of participation. At the conclusion of today's training, you can fill out the online feedback form. There'll be a link on the last slide. It's also available in the related link section. Once you fill out that online feedback form, you can click a box at the end of that form to certify you participated. Once you click that box and press submit, that certificate will be provided to you. Well, at this point, it looks like we've taken care of the questions back in writing directly to the people who have asked them. So I think we will go ahead and move on into the second portion of our presentation. We'll move on over to slide number 50, and I will turn it over to Ryan Wymore with CDM Smith. Ryan?
All right, thanks, Mary. So for this next part of the training, we're going to move to a little bit of a different topic. So the chapters 2 through 4 in the document and what we've heard so far has really been focused on the fundamentals, kind of the academic type information that our guidance document does a really great job of presenting and kind of laying the foundation. So for the conceptual site model section, which is chapter 5, we talk a little bit more about process and what steps you go through to build and revise a CSM at fractured rock sites. We'll hear from Tamsin after I'm done on remediation and how to develop and select remedies, and then John will talk about developing monitoring strategies at the end of the seminar today. So I want to start off by saying that in the guidance document and for our training here today especially, we're not presenting a comprehensive start-to-finish cookbook for building a fractured rock CSM. What we want to do is highlight some of the key elements that are unique to fractured rock sites and really spend time talking about those. So as our team was working on the process that we thought should be followed for revising or building a CSM, we realized we were pretty much just reproducing a process that was already out there in an earlier ITRC document that's already been mentioned today, the Integrated Site Characterization document that came out in 2015. So for the Fractured Rock document, we've sort of adopted that process, and we reference it. It's reproduced here on the right side of this slide. But rather than create our own process that was going to end up looking very similar to this, we are just incorporating this by reference. We talk about a few key elements of it, which I'll go through next. So here are kind of the key points of the CSM process with references to the sections in the guidance document. So to start off, you're really just kind of assessing where you're at. So most of the sites that we all work on, there's been some amount of work done. There's something known about the site. So you're starting off by assessing what you know. Then section 5.2, you're clearly defining the problem statement. So what do we know about the CSM? More importantly, what do we not know? You then translate that into data gaps. Think about the resolution requirement to address those data gaps. That's section 5.3. And then we want to establish data quality objectives for the data collection activities we're going to go out and perform to fill the data gaps. We have a section on selecting tools and techniques, and we actually have a separate resource for that that I'll talk about. And then we do talk about data interpretation, management, and presentation. So just in summary, you might start off thinking big picture, your initial characterization objective. Big picture, what are you trying to learn about your site? It could be something basic like determine the nature and extent of TCE and its daughter products, for example. Then you start thinking about resolving data gaps. There's maybe certain areas of your site where you don't have the detail or the level of detail that you want, so then you can identify data gaps. You translate those to data collection objectives, which are the what do we need to know. And then you consult the tools table, which is, okay, we've established what our objectives are. We establish what we want to know. Now, how are we going to get those data? So that's kind of an overview of the process. So one thing that our team realized pretty early on is, especially at fractured rock sites, there are always going to be things that you wish you knew more about, or areas of your site that you want more data, or you wish you had more data. So to try to avoid sort of unintentionally advocating like a continuous loop of characterization, one of our team members who was a state regulator brought to us this idea of a significant data gap. So rather than just the sort of normal definition of significant, he pointed out that in the guidance for his state, there was a specific definition of it, and that's shown here on the slide. It's basically if you're missing information that allows you to formulate a defensible interpretation of the data. So another way to think of it is you have a significant data gap if more than one conceptual site model can be supported by the data. So one example I like to use is another member of our team who worked for another state regulatory agency had a site where he had an L-shaped strip mall. So it was, not a big area, but at one end of the L was a current dry cleaner that was currently operating. The other end of the L, so kind of on the other side of the parking lot, was a site of a former dry cleaner. Right in the middle of those two facilities, kind of out in the parking lot, there was VOC contamination. And they had some information on what the concentrations were with depth, but they were missing what turned out to be a significant data gap because they didn't know which one of the facilities the contamination had come from, or maybe it was both. But so in that case, it's kind of a simplistic example, but that was a significant data gap that needed to be resolved for them to move forward. So in that case, as you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear, it turned out that it was the former, the historical dry cleaner that caused the contamination. And here's the reference for the guidance that I was mentioning. All right, so by way of example, this is a little bit simplistic, but just to really get the point across. Character objective, this is the big picture. Determine lateral and vertical extent of dissolve phase VOCs. So then your data gap is obviously that vertical and lateral extent is not known or not known well enough. So your data collection objectives may have something to do with what's shown on the slide. Maybe you need to learn more about fracture location, what the orientation of those fractures are, and of course VOC concentrations with depth at different areas throughout the site. So once you've set up your data collection objectives, you're establishing what you need to achieve or what you need to learn, then you go about deciding how to collect those data or what tools to use. So for this team, for the fractured rock team, we have created a tools matrix. It's an enhancement to the tools matrix that was created for that 2015 characterization document. We've put a little more in it, but it's set up the same way. It's a downloadable Excel spreadsheet that has tools segregated into categories and subcategories. You can get to it from the opening page of the Fractured Rock Guidance document, and you can see our little puzzle piece map kind of in the top center of this slide. If you click on the blue Selecting Tools puzzle piece, then you get this file to download. So I've got a few screenshots of what this looks like. So it contains over 100 tools, in this big, basically it's a big Excel table that we have some functionality to be able to sort and down select through. So you can sort by characterization objective. So in this case, that may be geology, hydrogeology, or chemistry. So depending on, you know, really what you're trying to learn about. You can sort it by effectiveness in media, whether it's unconsolidated or bedrock, whether it's saturated or unsaturated, and then by data quality, so the type of data returned by the tool. So it's quantitative, semi-quantitative, or qualitative. So just a word on the effectiveness in media category. We did, this table does include tools that only work in unconsolidated zones. And the reason we did that is to kind of be more holistic, because we realized that at some sites, or maybe a lot of sites where we work on that have fractured rock issues, there are also contamination or conceptual site model issues and the overburden as well that you may need to address simultaneously. So that's why we left those tools in here. If you really are just looking for tools that work specifically in fractured rock, then you can just make that menu selection of bedrock, and then you'll only get tools that work for bedrock. And then in terms of the data quality, quantitative, you get a concentration such as, you know, micrograms per cubic meter, milligrams per liter, that sort of thing. Semi-quantitative is a tool that returns specific information about individual compounds, but it's not quite the same as a concentration. You can't compare it to a standard. So an example might be a passive soil gas collector where you get data, you know, in terms of micrograms of a contaminant that are accumulated, but it's not the same as a concentration. And then qualitative are tools that have responses that are generally proportional to the level or to the concentration of a contaminant, but it's not the same as getting a concentration. So it's something like a membrane interface probe where you get a response in millivolts that correlates to the concentration, you know, of a organic contaminant, but it's not an actual measurement. So you can sort by all those things within the tools table. So the way it works is you can click on any of the boxes and you can get more information, you can get definitions. In this case, we have a description of what we mean by geology in this tools matrix. If you click on any tool, you can see they all appear as hyperlinks. Let's say you click on GPR and you get more information that pops up about that tool. You get additional reference material. If you don't want to read all those documents or papers, there's a summary of what the tool is, a description of how it works. And then we present the type of data that are generated from the tool, as well as the applicability and advantages, and then also limitations and difficulties. So when you make a set of selections and then do the search within the tools matrix, if you get a green box, then that means that that tool selects that type of information. So you can see as long as the tool has at least one yes or one green box returned, then it's going to show up as being on the list. All right, so definitely encourage everyone to check out the tools matrix, to download it, play around with it. It has a lot of good stuff and a lot of useful information in it. So realizing that we're still in the planning phase of the CSM process, I do want to talk for a minute about data interpretation, management, and presentation. And the reason that we do this is because at fractured rock sites, it's quite a bit different. And the main difference is when you do characterization at fractured rock sites, you can generate visuals or graphics that look like this. This is an integrated borehole log, where basically all the information you collect from an individual borehole, you can plot it on one graphic like this and look at everything together. So this is all plotted with depth down the left-hand side over here, depth below ground. And then working from left to right, you have televiewer data, which gives you information about where the fractures are, tadpole plot, which also comes from the televiewer data to get fracture, you know, where the fractures are, with depth in their orientation. You can get geophysical data. You get physical measurements. There's a caliper log here. You can also plot transmissivity with depth. There's methods out there to measure what the transmissivity is at specific depths. You can do the same with concentrations. Obviously, you can collect depth discrete concentrations. Flow metering, you can actually measure flow under pumped and ambient conditions to get an idea of where water is entering and exiting the borehole, along the vertical profile. And then you can include things like where you have sampling ports completed. So John will talk a little bit more about this in the monitoring section, but the reason we put it here is to think about this up front. So if you're going to be spending the money to install boreholes and you're going to do this kind of logging, you want to make sure you have the required software and expertise to be able to build these kind of figures so that you can interpret the data most efficiently. We do also have, and I should have mentioned on the last graphic, that's talked more about in the report in Chapter 5. This one is as well. This is simply a potentiometric surface for a fractured rock site. You do those just like you would for an unconsolidated site, although I've got an example in a few slides where maybe you don't interpret the data the same way, or I guess a cautionary tale of how to interpret potentiometric surface data at fractured rock sites. But in terms of data presentation, these should look familiar. And then the same with cross sections. You can still make cross sections at fractured rock sites if you generate enough data to do so. And again, this is talked about more in the document. This one is figure 5.6. So up to this point, we've been talking about setting objectives or identifying data gaps, setting objectives, selecting tools. At this point, you finish completing the work plan. So you document everything that you've done, all the selections that you've made. You put it in the work plan. It might look something like this, where you're going to drill some boreholes, collect rock cores, do some hydraulic testing, maybe some flow meter testing, aquifer testing, and then collecting samples, for example. So in the work plan, you want to emphasize these data collection objectives, present the process you're going to use, the tools that are going to be deployed in the field, and then, like I mentioned before, be forward-looking to discuss what kind of procedures or softwares or models that are going to be used for data evaluation and interpretation. And you want to include in your work plan how you're going to do that data evaluation. ITRC endorses a dynamic field approach for characterizing sites. This is talked about in a lot of our previous documents, including the 2015 characterization document. You can still do this to some extent at fractured rock sites. There are a lot of these logging tools or downhole tools that provide some form of field data or real-time data that you can be looking at. So your work plan should consider that and include that kind of information, how you're going to handle that. It should also cover when you're going to talk, when the field team is going to talk to the rest of the group in terms of looking at data and deciding what to do next, and how you're going to update the CSM. So one thing that we want to emphasize at fractured rock sites is that characterization activities must be designed to not spread contamination. So we recommend not leaving open boreholes where flow can occur between units that are previously disconnected or fractures that are not previously connected. If you drill a really long borehole and you don't do anything with it and you just leave it open for months and months, you can significantly redistribute contamination because you've basically created a conduit for water to move, up and down the borehole. All right, so the last part of this section, it's a few slides about a case study that we want to go through. And this case study is going to come up again in the remediation section and the monitoring section, so we're kind of carrying it through these last modules of the training. So we'll use it as an example of how to start at the regional scale to get information about what's going on at your site. We'll present information about the usefulness of measuring and looking at the fracture data, and then understand how the fracture data are really impacting things at the site, including how the potentiometric surface can be a little bit misleading if you don't look at other things. So this is the Solvents Recovery Service of New England Superfund site. This is a map showing where the site is. It's in central Connecticut. So here, this basically presents the process that was talked about early in the training. We're starting at the regional scale. So this is the terrain analysis. You can see at the top is that geologic cross-section, and then a plan view down at the bottom of the slide that shows where the site is located. So the light-colored unit at the bottom that you can see is a sequence of sedimentary rocks, and the red igneous rocks, or the red units are igneous rocks that are intruded between the layers of sedimentary rocks. So you can see the site is kind of right in that area. So this slide shows the general conceptual model of the bedrock at the site. So this is based on review of bedrock outcrops as well as some of the downhole fracture logging. So you can see there's a main set of fractures that consist of bedding plane fractures that dip gently toward the east-southeast, but then you have these cross-cutting fractures in portions of the site as well. So this slide shows fracture orientation data in a couple of different ways, and this is from some of the downhole logging that was done at the site using an optical televiewer. So at the top of the figure, you have the orientations of the dip vectors in a stereo net diagram. This shows that most of the dip vectors are clustered in the direction of the east-southeast. In the lower left part of the slide, this is a rows diagram that shows the same data and basically shows the same thing, that the majority of the fractures dip toward the east-southeast. And then the figure on the lower right shows the magnitude of the dip of the fractures. You can see that it's just a little bit below horizontal, something like 20 or 22 degrees. And again, it's very consistent across the site. So slide 71, this is a potentiometric surface map at this site. So a couple of things to point out. North is actually to the right on this figure. So the contour lines clearly suggest that water would be moving down toward this river, which of course would make sense. And this is east on the figure. The site source area is located right here. So these arrows sort of simplistically show, you know, water would flow toward the river, intercept contamination, and then take it toward the river. What actually ends up happening is the contamination goes south to the left on this figure. It goes this way. It does not go straight to the river. So interestingly, when the team was working on the modeling at this site, they were able to reproduce the hydraulic heads pretty accurately, but it still showed the plume going toward the river. So they had to incorporate this significant anisotropy term. And the reason that this is happening is, of course, you would infer, is because of the geology. So the structure in this localized area is that there's a dominant fracture set that goes from north to south, across the figure this way, that is dominant. It's controlling where the contamination goes. So this is, like I said, an example of where you just can't look at the hydraulic gradient. You also have to look at, you know, what the geology is telling you. And here, you know, it's kind of a stark difference because the plume is moving, you know, basically 90 degrees from what you would expect. These stars on this figure represent detections of DNAPLs, so where it was observed. So now we're going to kind of look at a cross-section where we're looking looking to the north, northeast. So this is kind of taking that last page, looking from left to right, kind of toward the north. And this is basically just orienting where the DNAPL detections appear relative to the fracture orientation. And you can see that they line up really well, which, of course, is not surprising that the DNAPL would find its way into the fractures. But the data point down at the bottom kind of makes you wonder, like, all right, how deep does this go? Are we going to, you know, do we need to be chasing, you know, DNAPL at hundreds and hundreds of feet at this site? As it turns out, thankfully, they didn't have to do that. This chart shows the mean fracture aperture versus depth. And basically what happens is as you get deep at the site, the fractures get very, very small and less frequent. So it turns out that they had the problem pretty well bounded with what the investigation at this site had shown. This last slide just shows some of the general properties of the bedrock at this site. So you have an outcrop with a man he's over 6'6" in this photo. So it's a tall person, just to give you a size of the scale. You can definitely see the fractures. You can see the dip. You can see that big, you know, all these characteristics from that outcrop. So sort of typical of this sedimentary bedrock, the matrix porosity is orders of magnitude higher than the fracture porosity, but the fractures are still important out here. So just a little bit of sort of fate and transport inferred data for this site. Like I mentioned, the site will come up again in the next couple of sections. So with that, I will turn it over to Tamsin to talk to us about remediation.
Thanks, Ryan. So moving on, we're going to switch gears a little bit now that we have gone through a lot of important information about the conceptual site model and discuss Section 6 of the guidance document, which is remedy selection. How can you develop remedial objectives for fractured bedrock sites, and how do you select a remedy for fractured bedrock sites? First is that often on the outset with these, because these sites are complex, really looking at how to manage sites long-term is important, and really evaluating whether conventional objectives for site restoration, such as achieving maximum contaminant levels, for instance, in groundwater, whether that's really achievable at fractured rock sites. And if it is, it's important to acknowledge that often that restoration is more challenging. Sometimes it's impracticable within reasonable time frames. And so it really becomes important as remedies are being developed to address things like the most critical risks, foster partial cleanups, look at interim objectives, do community outreach to address concerns with these long restoration timescales, be realistic about the costs for managing and implementing remedies at these sites, again, because they are a long-term management issue. And so really remedy implementation requires this careful development and consideration of a concept that we've talked a lot about in ITRC guidance documents, and that really is sort of functional objectives. As Ryan said, the integrated DNAPL site strategy document and the integrated DNAPL site characterization documents discuss these objectives and how to develop them. It's developing things like reducing risk, establishing reductions in things like contaminant mass flux and discharge, defining clear transition points from active to passive remedial options, such as M&A, you know, are often really critical for these sites. And really all of that is built on a robust CSM, being able to understand the complexities of the site and establish metrics that are SMART, as is shown in the bottom of the screen there, which is an acronym for this specific, measurable, applicable, relevant, and time-bound. And we're going to talk about what that means here shortly. So first really is, understanding this SMART acronym. Again, it's a concept that was originally developed in the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document. It's really acknowledging complexity, defining interim objectives, and deciding what makes sense for the site, what makes sense for the near term. In order to meet these criteria, this definition of a good objective, you often have to have realistic time frames. One of the thoughts from the ITRC team is to really develop these interim objectives or realistic expectations for what you can achieve within a 20-year period. I think CERCLA uses 30 years. So it really is, you know, considering what can be done in the near term, how can we establish these objectives, acknowledging uncertainty, which is always considerable at fractured rock sites, and in particular, also developing contingency plans because, again, because of complexity, often you get out there, you start implementing your remedial actions, you do some characterization, and realize that conditions are different. And so really having a contingency plan or adaptive site management can also be a critical component for these remedies. Special considerations for fractured bedrock sites. As has been discussed at length in this training, bedrock sites have a lot of challenges, especially when compared to overburden sites. There are really four main characteristics that you should really consider as additional challenges compared to overburden sites. And that really is the hydraulic conductivity or mass storage, which we've talked about a lot. Really just this very wide spectrum of potential hydraulic transmissivities, contaminant mass storage, you know, matrix diffusion issues, and, you know, those can play a big role in really understanding feasibility of remedial technologies and potential performance of technologies, which may perform better in the higher transmissivity features like the fractures compared to things like the primary porosity. Understanding NAPL, the presence of NAPL, distribution of NAPL, how that NAPL is migrating within that fractured rock system is really important. Understanding groundwater flow, direction, and flux, and uncertainties that exist in the groundwater flow patterns in fractured rock sites and are sometimes our inability to interpret the data that we're getting using conventional means. And Ryan provided a really good example of that in the SRNL case study where the apparent interpretation of the potentiometric surface was 90 degrees different than how chemicals were being transported in that fractured rock system, which was really being driven by the fractures themselves. So acknowledging those complexities and that often it requires more characterization to really understand what is going on. And then there's things like biotic and abiotic reactions. There's been a whole series of research and development in the idea of how do chemicals, not only how are they transported, but how do they attenuate or degrade in these systems, looking at features like back diffusion in these sedimentary rocks. Do chemicals attenuate when they're diffused in the primary porosity? And a colleague of mine, Charles Schaefer, and the Department of Defense's CERTIF and ESTCP program have been looking at that a lot and finding that, yeah, you can actually get, in some cases, some abiotic reduction of things like chlorinated solvents in that rock matrix. So accounting for those potential degradation reactions along with the other transport characteristics in fractured rock sites. So all of these things really influence rock types and how technologies perform in different rock types. Looking at an initial technology screening, you have to really first understand the type of rock that you're dealing with. And we've talked a lot in our conceptual site model about all these different bedrock types. We have the 21 compartment model, we have sedimentary rocks, we've got igneous, we've got metamorphic rocks. It really is important because each one of those rock types and their associated characteristics really influences how different treatment technologies work. And we'll go through that in a little bit shortly. in addition, the contaminant characteristics are important. Chemicals of concern, transport different. For example, contaminants that readily dissolve in groundwater may exhibit strong partitioning into the rock matrix by this matrix diffusion. And back diffusion may be a big deal for your site. However, if you have some of these abiotic reactions or degradation occurring, sometimes that can actually mitigate back diffusion issues. And so maybe it's not a big deal at your site, and really kind of understanding for your site specific characteristics, you know, are these phenomena important? Contaminants such as NAPLs may be transported great distances at a site where the rock has a large network of interconnected fractures. And so then you're really tracking out these particular fracture networks to try to figure out where that NAPL went and how it distributed within that fracture network. Again, referencing Ryan's SRNL case study and how that fracture flow, both laterally and vertically, really was driven, how that NAPL distribution was driven by that fracture network. And then different types of features or characteristics of rock, things like organic carbon, coal, for instance, can often affect the fate and transport characteristics of sorption and dissolution. And so really understanding all of those properties at your site are important. So we're going to go through, we've got this 21 compartment model. We've talked a lot about the conceptual site model for the site and what we've done to try to link some of this complexity to distill the characteristics of fractured rock sites and really kind of map potential remedies. We've developed this technology screening matrix, which is Table 6.2 in the guidance document. This is really intended to break this down and to give you an idea for how variations in bedrock properties, like their physical, their hydrologic, their chemical, the types of contaminants you're dealing with, are affected, or how different types of remedial technologies may work within those systems. And so this is, we'll kind of break this down a little bit, and I'll walk you through this screening matrix. So first, the table 6.2 summarizes the hydrology characteristics. As we've talked about a lot, you have the different rock types, sedimentary rocks, igneous metamorphic rocks, their particular characteristics, the rock types and origins here. And then we have this kind of high and low, which essentially defines whether or not, for instance, this sedimentary bituminous rock has a high matrix porosity, fracture porosity or transmissivity, and storage. And so each of these characteristics, both understanding the potential for matrix transmissivity, fracture transmissivity, and storage, all have important implications with feasibility of remedial technologies. And that's really borne out in kind of the second component. So here you've got the features, the characteristics of those rock types. Then you have the different types of, or classes, if you will, of remedial technologies, physical removal technologies, different containment technologies, chemical and biological technologies. So that's sort of across the top of this matrix. And so this is kind of going through your options, if you will, for different remedial technologies. Next is the example of whether or not each of these technology types is applicable for a given rock type. So this is kind of blowing up this portion of the matrix. So here we have physical removal technologies, and it essentially goes through physical removal, thermal, air sparge here, multi-phase extraction, and surfactant flushing. And we have this yes, or no, or unlikely that's assigned to each of these compartments, if you will. So for each of these different types of rocks, different rock characteristics, it goes through and says, you know, is removal applicable for that particular rock type? So these values are intended as a general guidance based on professional judgment and experience of the ITRC team. A value of no or unlikely should not necessarily be interpreted as a conclusion that you should absolutely not consider that technology, but our experience and the collective experience of the team was that it probably wasn't. Ultimately, that decision must be based on your site characteristics, your remedial objectives, and as innovations in design and advances in technologies come to the marketplace, you should definitely apply those, and that may change the applicability of these technologies moving forward. So we're going to go through each type of remedial technology, and I'm going to not necessarily go through exhaustive descriptions of each of these technology types, but really just a very high-level summary with some considerations for how these technologies are applicable or specific considerations in Bedrock. So first is really kind of what we call physical technologies, and this encompasses the suite of technologies that physically remove chemicals of concern. So you either have physical removal like excavation, you can have thermal where maybe you're trying to change the phase of the chemicals of concern and extract and treat or do multi-phase extraction. You might be doing in situ thermal desorption where you're actually heating the subsurface up and trying to chemically or thermally break down the chemicals within the rock type, and things like air sparge. So this is all sort of, you know, recovery and physical removal technologies. These technologies can be applied to fracture rock sites. They're more commonly applied to sources compared to plumes just because they tend to be very intensive in terms of material, time, engineering, and they also tend to be very expensive and even more so in bedrock systems typically. So you want to use these technologies judiciously in remedies. Next is in kind of the physical properties, this kind of subset, we have vapor and multi-phase extraction. Vapor extraction methods are widely used for volatile chemicals in unsaturated zones. They can be used in bedrock. Vapor extraction is, again, a typical component of things like thermal remediation and can be combined in bedrock environments with other technologies like in situ chemical oxidation. The vapor migration pathway characterization and the risks associated with that can be more challenging to understand in bedrock systems relative to overburden systems because a lot of flow and transport is being driven by the fracture networks themselves. And so things like preferential flow paths can have an entirely different meaning in bedrock systems. So the characterization, again, must define, you know, that fracture network, assess potential vapor flow pathways in order to really effectively design and implement those systems. Similarly, multi-phase extraction in the saturated zone is and the VEDA zone is widely applied at fractured rock sites. It has been applied successfully, but again, because the distribution and transport characteristics of the chemicals are really driven by the fracture network, these systems can be, again, more challenging to design compared to a typical overburden. So next is in our physical technologies is surfactant and co-solvent flushing. These are a suite of technologies that describe injecting chemicals or a compound that enhance mobilization of NAPLs. These injected compounds along with the mobilized NAPL is subsequently extracted. The advantage of this technology in bedrock is enhanced recovery of relatively insoluble NAPL phases that might be immobilized on fracture surfaces such as coal tars or petroleum hydrocarbons. Specific challenges with using this technology in fractured rock, again, are really related to how these fluids and napples move in fractured rock systems and how they can potentially be mobilized with things like multi-phase extraction, which is generally required. Also, you get a lot of preferential fluid migration of the injected surfactant or co-solvents within highly transmissive large aperture fractures. And one really important consideration is that because of these complexities and the fact that surfactants and co-solvents actually change the properties of the napple itself, you should be very careful in considering designing and applying these technologies in fractured rock systems, because if you don't have hydraulic or pneumatic vapor containment and control of the mobilized chemicals, you could inadvertently distribute or mobilize chemicals that are not then subsequently captured. So because of that, we actually, in the ITRC 2003 guidance document on this technology, ITRC actually recommended against using this technology in fractured rock aquifers. Pump and treat technologies. This is a widely applied technology. I think probably everybody on the phone knows what pump and treat is. So in general, these systems, again, are more complicated to design and implement in bedrock systems compared to overburden or unconsolidated systems, again, because of the substantially greater heterogeneity and anisotropy in bedrock systems. Because of this, often design of multi-phase extraction, pump and treat technologies, surfactant, co-solvent flushing, anything that really relies on capture often requires extensive studies, pilot testing, pumping tests, tracer tests, really to optimize the design and ensure that those systems are implemented and are achieving the objectives of either mobilizing or containing the chemicals of concern in the fractured bedrock system. And we're going to go through an example of that with the SRNL case study. So really, you know, you need to understand often in more fine scale what the features of your fractured rock site are. Next is containment technologies. These are things like permeable reactive barriers, injecting amendments into the fracture network that then is intersecting a contaminant or chemical plume, or different types of media which may, for instance, sorb the chemical. So either a physical sorption removal process or in situ chemical or biological treatment process. This technology in fractured bedrock systems requires accurate fracture identification, understanding where those transmissive fractures are, where the transmissive fractures that are conveying a chemical plume are, really making sure that you are capturing or intersecting that chemical plume, and that you're able to deliver whatever the media is that is treating that plume within that fracture network. And so generally, these systems are best applied for sites that have a lot of fracture porosity or secondary porosity, where you can really, you know, deliver amendments to those larger fracture networks and intersect that chemical plume. Next is chemical and biological treatment technologies. These are technologies that rely on injecting amendments like chemical oxidants or chemical reductants or different amendments that stimulate microbial activity to break down chemicals of concern. So we're kind of going to talk about all of these together because the complexities, ITRC has developed a number of guidance documents specifically on these technologies, both chemical oxidation, chemical reduction, in situ bioremediation. So definitely refer to those other guidance documents on specifics of the technology itself. But when you're talking about applying these technologies in fractured bedrock sites, again, the formation hydraulics, the mineralogy, this primary versus secondary porosity, the potential for matrix storage and back diffusion, and the fracture network itself are all considerations in developing the remedial designs for the injection systems needed to deliver amendments and select and successfully treat your chemicals of concern. So again, there are also other considerations for the technologies. Often things like chemical oxidant demand, for instance, can vary in fractured rock sites. Sometimes it's low and sometimes it's high. And so making sure you're getting that site-specific data for the chemicals that you're planning on using. In addition to kind of engineered or enhanced in situ bio or chemical reduction, you also have natural attenuation, and these are technologies that are also widely applied that can be used to mitigate chemicals of concern. And again, it really relies on understanding all of the attenuation mechanisms that are relevant in fractured rock sites, things like sorption characteristics, potential for biotic and abiotic degradation reactions in the primary porosity of your bedrock and in the secondary porosity, understanding how the sorption characteristics might vary in your secondary system. So all the typical things that you have to understand to get acceptance of a M&A system, you also have to understand for a fractured rock site. Combined remedies. As with many complex sites, fractured bedrock systems often are going to require a combined remedy. And that is really because of the complexity of these systems and the unique set of site conditions that is characteristic of these sites. So what works in the secondary fracture zone of your source, you know, may be something different than what you might want to apply in your dissolved phase plume, how you might try to address mass that's diffused into your primary porosity, you know, may require a different treatment. So really understanding how you can apply technologies, applying different technologies or coupling technologies in time where you have one technology then followed by another technology, or space where you're applying different technologies simultaneously but at different parts of the site, you know, is often implemented at these sites. And so, again, going back to your 21-compartment model, you really need to understand how those chemicals are distributed to understand how you might map technologies to different compartments within your specific conceptual site model. And because of all of these considerations, for bench and field pilot tests can be really important to develop a site-specific remedy for your fractured rock system. You know, understanding contaminant treatability, rock chemistry interactions, the reagents that you're using, long-term prospects, and the response that you expect from the treatment process you're implementing, you know, are all things that you can test in bench or pilot studies. I would say that in a lot of cases, it's actually more important to do bench and pilot tests for potentially applicable technologies at fractured rock sites than other systems like unconsolidated sites. So we're going to go through our SNE case study again and the learning example. In this case, we're going to talk about how hydraulic containment was modeled. In that case, of course, there was a pump and treat system that was implemented. There was some concerns about the effectiveness of that pump and treat system, and then also to understand the multiple lines of evidence that are needed. And again, in fractured rock systems, it's even more important to get that multiple lines of evidence to confirm that the remedy is working and that it's protective. In this case, again, the Solvents Recovery Service of New England, the record of decision for this site required complete delineation and hydraulic containment of groundwater with VOCs above MCLs. So again, first had to understand how the source, the NAPL, was distributed, understand how and where the plume was migrating. And as Ryan said, the fracture flow system was really very different and determined how groundwater migrated. So using the calibrated mod flow model that accounted for the anisotropy, that accounted for the bedrock hydraulic complexity, the containment system was designed to include both overburden and bedrock extraction wells. And the capture zone for those extraction wells was really verified using multiple lines of evidence, including modeling, hydraulic head mapping, VOC concentration trend analysis, down gradient of the interpreted capture zone, and really looking at things like particle tracking simulations of this system, verified to all the stakeholders that the VOCs were being contained within the capture zone of that system. The argument was successfully made that the current and future risks and exposure were controlled because the VOCs do not exceed drinking water standards beyond that capture zone. They were getting hydraulic containment, it was being effective, and that the plume extent was really beneath a large cemetery, so land use and potential risks for the land use were being mitigated. And there was also existing and town ordinances or land use controls prohibiting things like drilling or using potable water in the area. So really this multifaceted approach verified that the risks and risk pathways were being mitigated as required in the ROD. So overall, the other important consideration for this site, in addition to hydraulic containment, was MNA. The distal dissolved plume was being attenuated, and the that attenuation process had to continue to be monitored, where parameters for geochemistry and microbes that were known to degrade the chemicals of concern, which included things like VOCs, 1,4-dioxide, and tetrahydrofuran, were being evaluated to ensure that the attenuation process was occurring and ultimately meeting remedial objectives. And so with that, that kind of concludes our remedy portion of the training, and I'm going to turn it over to John Dougherty.
Tamsin. So up to this point, we've talked about the differences and similarities between fractured bedrock sites and unconsolidated sites, looked at the importance of developing site conceptual models and how characterization tools are applied in that, and then talked about remedial action objectives and remedies. So I'm going to talk now for a few minutes about monitoring at fractured bedrock sites. Okay. And of course, monitoring needs to take into account and be rooted in the results of your site characterization work, and then focus on what information is needed to help you select a remedy and look at the remedy's performance. There's three types of monitoring that are typically looked at: compliance monitoring, looking at regulatory requirements, especially with respect to protecting human health and the environment, operational and progress and performance monitoring, which are looking at the operation of the remediation system and its performance with respect to the various goals. Media that are monitored in any monitoring program, whether it's in rock or bedrock or in unconsolidated media, is typically going to focus on groundwater, also may include surface water, and then sometimes may include subsurface gas if, for example, vapor intrusion is an important pathway. So network design, again, as in any site, it's rooted in your site characterization and your understanding of the site. But what makes fractured bedrock sites unique is the strong influence of things like
the fracture network and bedding orientation on groundwater flow direction. So the other thing, of course, that's always important is where are the potential receptors, and understanding the influence of the fracture network and bedding orientation on groundwater flow directions is important to understanding where those receptors are. So when we look at monitoring location selection, again, we look at the site characterization and what it's telling us about the fracture network, where the most transmissive features are located, for example, what their orientation is, how that relates to groundwater flow direction and gradient, and then what's the geochemistry in these zones that we need to be characterizing. And the types of monitoring locations would typically include wells in the source zone, in the impacted zone, or in the area where receptors are. Distal portions or boundary areas to look at whether or not the plume is moving or changing over time. And then upgradient or cross-gradient wells and so-called sentinel wells, which again are usually installed to see if the plume is moving in an area you don't want it to move over time. Ryan showed an example, this example earlier, of what we call an integrated borehole geophysical log. And the point of this tool is to allow you to accumulate in one place information from various tools and analyze that data and apply it to your monitoring network design. So in this case, we have borehole geophysical data in these columns here. The data has been analyzed using tools in the software to identify fracture orientation. That's what this tadpole plot tells you. And if you notice here on this plot, there are sine waves. Those are fitted by the analyst to the underlying image. And then we have a flute transmissivity profile here. So this is another piece of information collected with a different technology that's brought in. Heat pulse flow meter data collected at the same time the borehole geophysical data is collected, and then sample results collected during a different event. That information is integrated and used to design, in this case, a monitoring well. The data is also used in our analysis of not only conditions in the borehole, but conditions at the site as a whole. So how do we know what the fracture network looks like? And you know, so we can use that information to assess the influence on groundwater flow. It's by using tools such as a stereo net here. The data, the poles that you see here in the stereo net are coming directly from the tadpole plot or this feature plot over here. These are really the same thing, just two different presentations of it. This information is for this specific borehole, and it can be combined with information from other boreholes, so you can look at these things like the feature orientation over the entire site. So let's now talk about EPA guidance for looking at monitoring during remedy implementation. And you know, they look at focusing on remedy operation, progress towards goals, the cleanup levels and RAOs, and other factors. So we're going to look at a case study from Greenville. It's a former industrial site, and they're monitoring groundwater and surface water in this case. And what we know about the site in general terms of its geology and subsurface conditions, there's a weathered bedrock zone grading into a competent bedrock zone. The matrix porosity is low in this competent rock. Fractures are predominantly subhorizontal. And then water-bearing fractures were easily identified. The existing network includes 15 wells in source areas, 37 in impacted areas, upgradient, cross-gradient, and sentinel wells, wells around the ZVI barrier, which is part of the remedy, and they're conducting periodic surface water sampling also. So using this as an example, we're going to look at how the network was designed and look at methods that can be used to reduce cost over time as you begin to accumulate data and understand trends at the site. So remember, we talked about the shallow zone, which is weathered, and the deeper zone, which is more competent. So at the site, they have wells installed in so-called shallow bedrock and deep bedrock. They've been doing sampling annually, and as frequently as twice a year, or sorry, every 2 years for M&A parameters. And they sample comprehensively every 5 years. So this is what the data set from this well looks like over a period of 7 years of results from sampling events every 2 years. So quite a lot of data, and it clearly shows the downward trend in concentrations. So one question, you know, you can address with this kind of data set is, can we do sampling at less frequency and still identify the trend in the data, but save the cost of the additional sampling? So an approach was taken to look at that. What happens if we sample every 2 years and we still see the same trends? So using that information, in this case, the information was presented to the regulator with some statistical analysis, which are included in other ITRC guidance. And the regulator was able to approve reduction in sampling, which saved significant resources for the project. So our overall course summary, you know, one of our overall objectives is to try to address or dispel the myth that fractured bedrock sites, you know, are impossible or they're difficult, but they can be cleaned up, they can be managed. So looking at the guidance document, you know, each one of the things that we've talked about here relates back to chapters in the guidance document. And I want to emphasize again the value of the tools matrix. There are a lot of different tools available for subsurface characterization, a lot of which people may not be familiar with, especially borehole geophysical tools. And this matrix helps you understand what these tools are and how they can be applied in your context. Our goal here is to help you identify and understand the importance of developing good conceptual models, setting realistic objectives for your remediation, selecting the best option, and then monitoring the performance and results of that so you can feel confident and make effective decisions to remediate these sites. And with that, I'll say thank you for your attention and turn things back over to Mary.
Thanks, John. We do have some time for questions and answers. If you do have a question, you're welcome to type it in that Q&A pod. Just a couple things before we get to the questions and answers. I'm going to pull up a couple more full questions for you to complete. If you take a moment to do that, we would appreciate it. Also, we would like to get your feedback today on how the course went for you. If you would fill out our online feedback form, you can either access it from the link on this slide or over in the related links section by clicking on feedback and then browse to. If you are someone who needs documentation of continuing education and would like to receive a certificate of participation, be sure to fill out that online feedback form. At the bottom of that form, there's a box for you to click on to certify you participated today. Once you click on that box and press submit, that certificate will be provided to you. So let's move now to some questions. This is slide, John. We also had a question come in. It says, what information do the tadpole diagrams indicate?
Okay. The tadpole plot is, it's called a tadpole plot because of the way it looks. You've got the head of the tadpole, if you will, and then the tail. And the head of the tadpole is positioned according to the dip angle. So the farther to the right the tadpole is, the steeper the dip of the feature. And then the the tail points along dip azimuth. So it's easier to, you know, see what all that means if you look at the stereo net to the right, which takes the orientation data that the tadpoles represent and plots it. In this case, it's a lower hemisphere Schmidt projection. And it shows three clusters of poles, and those are indicative of a set of features dipping to the southwest, to the northeast, and then to the northwest.
All right, thank you, John. The use of tracers was mentioned. Could you say more about how those can be successfully used to refine the conceptual site model and determine flow paths prior to remediation? Who would like to take that?
This is John. I can.
Sorry.
I can. Go ahead, Tams.
Okay. Can you hear me? Having a hard time getting my phone off mute. So tracer tests can actually be a really good means of assessing flow paths, and generally, you can do it a variety of ways. There are different kinds of tracers. A standard tracer test, though, where you have, say, an injection well, where you put a slug of tracer in and then a series of monitoring wells positioned around that injection well to try to capture, ideally continuously, the tracer arrival within those monitoring wells, and then conducting a mass balance to look at the tracer within those monitoring wells is a standard means of doing the tracer studies. Often it's really important to get that continuous data, so we like to use tracers, either dye tracers or ion tracers, where you can deploy an ion probe, things like bromide, chloride, so that you can get those continuous measurements, because very often, particularly in fractured rock sites, you'll find that preferential flow paths dominate. And often you'll have bulk, conductivity or transmissivity estimates that are much lower than the transmissivity within a given, say, secondary fracture network, on a much finer scale. So when you look at transport times within those fracture networks, they're often a lot lower, or the transport, the velocities of the tracer in those fracture zones are much greater than what you might expect using those bulk estimates. So, getting good high-res data, continuous monitoring, so you can really try to map where you're seeing the tracer within that network, and then doing a mass balance to figure out how much you'll get the full tracer curve, so that you can integrate the area under the curve and get a mass balance on how much tracer you were actually able to quantify and observe at that particular location is also really important. A lot of times if you have preferential pathways or pathways that are not, you cannot observe with your monitoring system, that ends up showing up as the inability to get that good mass balance.
Thank you, Tamsin. We do have time for one more question before we wrap up, and the question says, what experience do you have with utilizing induced polarization coupled with electrical resistivity geophysics for identifying gasoline El Napa with fractures or karst?
This is John. Let me ask, as you're talking about surface geophysical techniques, I think, right? Yeah, I see the question here.
And he confirmed, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have not had experience trying to use those methods, the surface methods.
I can speak to that a little bit, John, if you'd like.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
go ahead.
So in general, we have used those methods on several sites and several fractured rock sites. And, you know, like any geophysics, you're relying on a geophysicist, you know, interpreting a lot of really complex data, you know, about how, in this case, with the case of ERT, things like electrical currents are migrating through the subsurface environment. And they're trying to do some interpretations based on that data. So generally what you get is a map of essentially kind of what the field looks like, and then you get, you know, areas where they have identified often what they call sort of anomalies. And so it's very imprecise to begin with. And, you know, then what you do is typically go out and do boring investigations or other investigations to try to figure out if those anomalies are meaningful or not. Our experience with mapping NAPL in general, both unconsolidated and bedrock sites, is that we have really not had a good system where we have been able to resolve the NAPL confidently. And we've done it in, you know, shale and sandstone. Now, you know, if you have clearly different, you know, background fields and highly, highly saturated systems where the NAPL saturations are very high and you have kind of continuous, or you think you have continuous NAPL bodies, which we didn't have at the sites we were implementing. It was more thin, residual, you know, layers, maybe, say, you know, a few feet or 10 feet thick in a system that was relatively deep, you know, 50 or 60 feet deep. You know, we just were not able to resolve it. But if you have a shallow system, you have a pool of NAPL, you know, that's pretty highly saturated, you know, you might have more success. But in a karstic system, I think there would be a pretty low probability of success.
Thanks, Tamsin. We do need to go ahead and wrap up today. We sure appreciate everybody asking your questions and for the trainers answering those questions. If we haven't addressed your question fully, please let us know by emailing us at training@itrcweb.org. Thanks so much for our trainers for not only sharing their expertise with us today, but all in all the past courses and for developing the associated guidance document. And thanks to the participants for spending time with us today. We hope you'll join a future ITRC training event. Be sure to fill out our feedback form. And if you have any interest in becoming a member of ITRC or learning more about how you can actively participate, be sure to visit itrcweb.org. Thanks so much for joining us today, and have a great day.